Fantastico, Paul. Well, there's a science of mind because there's a principle of mind. And we've been using the month of January to become more familiar with the way this principle works so that we can live life, our lives, more intelligently. Last week, we said that this principle works for us by working through us, and it works through us as mind. We went on then to think about the two aspects of mind, saying that we called our conscious mind the initiator of an idea, the point at which God creates as an individual, and we called our subconscious or subjective mind the transformer of the idea into an experience. Subconscious mind is often referred to as the mental law that does the transforming. In fact, that's where Dr. Holmes got the idea of calling the religion that he formulated religious science, because we're thinking about the concept of God, hence the word religious, because we're thinking about the concept of law, science. So he put them together as religious science. Now, this is certainly a bit more complicated than what we think of as the old-time religion. After all, it was much simpler when we believed in sin, and that the way we lived our lives was either buying a ticket to heaven or a ticket to hell. Yes, it was simpler, but it was based on superstition. So we're studying the science of mind to eliminate the age-old myths and replace them with age-old wisdom. Now, some people called our religion a New Thought religion, along with several others. But it's really old wisdom. In her book, New Thought, Common Sense, Ella Wheeler Wilcox, one of my favorite thinkers, wrote these words: "The idea that nothing exists in the universe but God, and that by our conscious unity with God we attain health, bliss, and immortality, is the very foundation stone of the Vedas. It is at least presumptuous for anyone in this age to claim it as a new discovery, calling it new thought." It isn't new thought. "The Vedic philosophy encompasses the oldest spiritual texts of any religion in the world. So the basis of all new thought religions, Religious Science International, Unity, even what I think of as a new thought religion, though they don't, Christian Science, as well as divine science, has been around for a long time." Well, regardless of whether it's been around a long time or not, if it's superstition, it's superstition. And the truth is the truth. The existence of a heaven and a hell are superstitious beliefs that have and are still, to some degree, used to control people. You know, the whole concept of reward and punishment are great carrots on a stick. If I can convince you that there is a reward for doing something or a punishment for doing something else, it isn't very long before I'll have you convinced that I'll tell you how to create both. Well, that day is long gone. I believe that Dr. Holmes really hit on the truth when he said heaven and hell are both states of being. But he made no attempt to talk about what the alternative was in his mind, which is immortality. I believe that heaven is a life experience of believing in one's goodness with all that is good. And hell is the experience of believing that one is separated from all that is good. We all know the hell of wanting something and not believing that we can either have it or cause it or experience it in some way. That's hell, and that's an experience we can have right here. And we all know the heaven of wanting something that we believe that we can have or create or experience. Well, Dr. Holmes believed in immortality, and as I said, he never attempted to define what continuing life would be like. I'll bet he can now, somewhere, talking about to someone what continuing life really means. Well, the question is, do we need to believe in immortality to benefit from the science of mind? I really don't believe we do. That, again, is my opinion. After all, if one day we wake up in a different realm, and I think we will, what's going to count then is the same thing that counts now, our knowledge of how life works. I believe that the principle of life exists wherever we are. And if we are now living the only life that we get to live, the only expression of life there is, we still need to learn how to navigate successfully. We still have to learn how to navigate intelligently. So the sooner we learn what this principle is and how to use it effectively, the better we'll be. If your intuition tells you that you're immortal, then so be it. If your intuition has nothing to say about the idea of immortality one way or another, well, then so be it. I believe that no matter where we are, there will always be a need for something to initiate action. Whether we're reading a book, whether we're riding a bicycle or building a bridge, there always needs to be some reality that allows us to instigate action. Why? Because life doesn't happen through us. We're living life. We are life. Life happens through us. So we need something with which we can negotiate our experience of life. Your conscious mind is that something. Your conscious mind is the negotiator. It chooses. It can be called a negotiator, an initiator, a navigator, a mediator, or the spokesperson for the kind of experience, the kind of life you want. And here comes the two aspects of mind. Conscious mind impresses subjective mind, and an experience is born. You've been doing it since you were born, that very thing. Whether you were conscious of it, realized it or not, that's what you've been doing all along. I don't think we need to argue with people who believe in heaven and hell and sin. And there are people, you know them and so do I, who believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible. We simply don't agree. I think there's a lot of good stuff in the Bible, but if you've actually read any great deal of the Bible, it's scary. Some of it cannot be true, and we intuitively know that it isn't, and to take it literally is folly, in my opinion. My intuition leads me to believe that we experience heaven and hell right here during this lifetime. Now, what makes us different in the world of religion is that our approach is the study of ourselves. And a belief that there's not something wrong with us that needs to be corrected, but rather there's something right with us that needs to be revealed. And you can spend life either way. One is devastating, it's so negative, to carry around with you the belief that there is something intrinsically wrong with you that you have to correct. And you may be drawn to a religion because they give you the hint that maybe they'll give you the information with which you can correct this something dreadful that's wrong with you. You can also believe there's something right with you. That's why you're drawn here, to hear about that something right all the time, because that's what we teach in this very center. There's something right with you that you need to recognize. And there's something right that needs to be revealed. Well, that's what the science of mind is, isn't it? A study of the self and the relationship that the self has with the universe. Think of it. We're in the right universe as a right being. And our only purpose in life is to realize how right we are. How whole we are and how perfect we are. It's said that the study of God reveals man. And the study of man reveals God, for they're one and the same thing. One is universal, the other is an individualized expression of the universal. Like the wave in the ocean, all one thing. We study the self because we know that we're not lost souls trying to redeem ourselves. We are the point at which God's infinite intelligence is living as an individual. Well, we don't then decide to understand the science of mind and use it constructively because it satisfies our religion, but rather because it satisfies our soul. Doesn't something in you quicken to the idea of what you hear here? Very often, I listened to a practitioner, which I did this morning, and both what Sherry Mandon said and Jim Evering said in our pre-service treatment. And when the truth is spoken simply, it quickens something in me that says, yes, that is the truth. I accept it for myself. I accept it for all people. Just remember that a great truth is simple. Dr. Holmes said one of the greatest truths I've ever heard, and I've quoted it in the last 2 weeks. There is a meaning, there is a depth and meaning to your own being. And if you can discover it, it'll answer all your questions. That's great because it really means something that liberates me from all religions, from all churches, including this one. That's why I say the science of mind is a study of ourselves. There's a depth and meaning to me that I have to discover. And if I discover that depth and meaning, not what rides on the surface of my mind, what I'd like, what I don't like, who I don't like, all of which I have an opinion, all of which you have an opinion. But if I go deeper in consciousness and get the sense of meaning, the meaning of my life, inevitably it will reveal to me the answers to the questions that I might have. Well, what questions do I have? Who am I? Why am I here? What is it all about? Alfie. Well, I know what it's all about now. I'm beginning to understand as I delve into the depth and meaning of my own being that what it's all about is strictly what I say it's all about. And if I say it's all about sin and punishment and reward and it's a struggle up a hill to get a sense of recognition from somebody, God lets somebody recognize me, then that indeed is what it's all about. Why? Because what it's really all about is what the individual says it's all about. That's why I say our study is the study of ourselves. It satisfies ourselves, our souls rather, to know that the life force is within our minds. And the creative process exists within our minds, which means it satisfies our souls to know that our experience of life depends on what our mind does to itself. What your mind does to itself, that's what your life is all about. What you're doing to yourself. Now, we get to think that life is all about our jobs and our family and all of those things, but they're all secondary. It's what you're doing to yourself in regards to your job. It's what you're doing to yourself in regards to your family. It's what you're doing to yourself in regards to money, in regards to health, in regards to everything. And we can do wonderful things to the self, to the mind which we are. Or we can do horrible things to ourselves. It may be a little awesome at first to come into religious science and have this totally new approach to life. Consciously using a principle that is within us rather than just taking whatever comes along, because that's the way I lived my life for many years. I just took what came along, and I didn't give God or the devil praise for it or power to create either. But I just thought, not considering the fact that I was causing them, I just thought whatever comes along came along, and I could make the best of it or the worst of it. Sometimes I did, sometimes I did the other. This could be a tough religion, especially for those of us who spent so many years believing in the myth of a sky god in heaven and a devil in hell. And there was always a pull on each side. When you wanted to do something you know was bad, the devil was pulling you. When you wanted to do something righteous and wonderful, God was getting God's way with you. Well, it's simply a myth, isn't it? That may have existed a long time ago, but it's amazing when I watch Sunday morning TV, how there are people, and when I look in the audience and see thousands of people screaming and yelling at this idea, I think to myself, there's work to be done, Blanche. Yeah. And I'm not like Tom Cruise, who says Scientology is the only one that can do it. Did you see that thing in the whatchamacall? He has a right to say that. But I know that we're not the only ones that can do it. Anyone, regardless of what the bulk of their religious beliefs are, anyone who takes an affirmative approach to life, basically affirmative approach to life, can help accomplish this. Now, I don't think it's an affirmative approach to life to believe that you're damned by the devil or God for not doing something right. Because that's a belief in karma. And we believe that when it comes to karma, you can set a new train of causation in the twinkling of an eye. Well, the only path to personal power, personal authority, personal dignity, and personal freedom is knowing the truth. And where there is personal freedom, there is also personal and individual responsibility. As individuals, we're responsible for using the creative principle within us in a way that causes a fulfilled life. And nobody can do it for us. Only you can create fulfillment in your life. Now, that's a pretty scary thing for people who are waiting and depending on the devil or God for anything. But it's a day of liberation for the person that says, yes, only I can fulfill my life. Only I can satisfy my soul. And by God, I'm going to find out information that allows me to do exactly that. Only you can satisfy your soul. Only you can give power to the truth that you are a self-reliant being. Because that's what you are. But only you can give power to the idea. Your mate can't do it. Your minister can't do it. Nobody can do it. Your practitioner can't do it. You got to do it. The greatest advice ever given in regards to the idea of self-reliance was written by Emerson when he simply said, "Trust thyself." Every heart vibrates to that iron string. Trust thyself. We go through life very often not trusting ourselves, having an intuitive gleam of what is, and yet casting it aside because someone speaks louder, with more authority, or it sounds like they, the religion or the person, seems to know more than we do. But something in us that attracts the ideas that are affirmative says, no, that can't be the way it is. It's got to be something that's more inspiring. Why? Because life is good. Sometimes I reduce all of my religious reactions to stuff, my own religion and others, to a belief that life is good. And if you don't believe life is good, everything that follows that belief will fall prey to, well, whatever you say. If you believe that life is a struggle, that life is hard, that life is a sentence to be endured rather than a great experience to have, well, then so be it. But it's that way because you said it's that way. Because you've used the principle of your own being, your own mind, to create that concert of ideas in your own mind, and therefore it's your experience or it's mine. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. The thing that most men have in common, especially most great men, is that somehow they trust that there is not something wrong with them that needs to be corrected, but something right with them that they need to get on experiencing. Martin Luther King, who we're celebrating today, did this, and so did many others. I couldn't help but think, and it was just sort of an accident that this person came to my mind, but it was George Washington Carver. He's another example. Here's a man who went from abject slavery to being one of the world's finest and well-thought-of agriculturalists, a man who was denied access, get this, to a grade school education, to a high school education, and to a college education, and each time simply because of his color. But you know what he did? He left his adopted parents in grade school to find a grade school who, when he knocked on the door and said, "Can I come in?" they welcomed him in. He kept looking until he found one. Now, I'm going to guess that he was in the first grade when he did this, or some such young age. And that took guts, a guts that he had all his life. He trusted himself. Well, he devoted his life to agriculture, and the products he created out of peanuts and soybeans revolutionized the economy of the South, liberating it from the overdependence on cotton. He said there's got to be more that the South has to offer the world than cotton. He is also known, by the way, for developing crop rotation methods that conserve nutrients in the soil. It had never been realized before that. That if you plant a different plant in the soil in season, it doesn't take the same qualities out of the soil that maybe another plant does. So crop rotation says, now we'll use this plot of land for this crop. When the season changes, we'll now use it for something else. He tells the story of holding a handful of peanuts in his hand. That's where you hold a handful of things. And he looked up in the sky and said, because his God was still a sky God, and that's all right. He believed in the responsiveness of that God. And whether we believe in God or an outer God, if we believe in the responsiveness of God to our world, well, it serves the same purpose. It serves a little better purpose if you know God is in you, because then God is with you every second of the day. But he looked up to the sky and he said, God, tell me what I can do with these peanuts. And his intuition guided him. And in my research this week, I couldn't find out exactly what he did with the peanuts or what form they took or products they took, but that's what he did. Yes, George Washington Carver did not let his color stop him or his roots in slavery stop him. He simply set out to express what was right with him in the best way he knew how. And somehow he knew as a kid that he had to get educated. What do you sit here this morning simply knowing you really should do, and yet you have a reason for not doing it? If you have a valid reason, then you're using your greatness in a very small way, rather than saying, I'm a great person. Not because of my values, not because of what I'd like to do, but because I exist. I'm a great person. Dare we say that right now? I'm a great person. Say it with me. I'm a great person. Do you believe that? Yes. It's true. You are a great person because God is a great power, and God is that which you are. Well, what did he do? What did George Washington Carver do? He took responsibility for using the creative principle with him in a way that caused fulfillment for him, in a way that satisfied his own soul. I think this is the greatest accomplishment known to mankind. Taking what we think is right with us and making the best of it. Taking what's right with you and making the best of it. What we often do is say, well, what's right with me isn't particularly wonderful, and so I don't know really how to make the best of it. But you do know what your perks are. You know what your talents and abilities are. You know the thing that is hidden in you right now, trying to get out, looking for the avenue of your own mind for recognition. You know what that greatness is, and you're either opening yourself up to letting it out or you're holding it in because you're afraid that it might not be good enough. It might not be great enough. But God says, if God could talk as a person, how dare you do anything but celebrate your greatness? Because I put it in you for you to recognize, for you to express, and more importantly, for you to experience. We're all looking to experience something. Holmes says, he thinks the main thing we're looking for is to experience God. If you don't think you'll ever experience God, you do have to accept that you can experience your own greatness. And you don't have to wait till you get out of this theater to do that, or next week or next year. You can do that right now. By affirming I am a great person, you're affirming a great truth. The most important thing that is right about us is that nothing in the universe exists but God. And by our conscious unity with God, we attain health, bliss, and everything that's good. You know, religious science shares a few beliefs with Buddhism, and though there are a lot of differences, we share some beliefs. For instance, Buddhism doesn't recognize the idea behind sin because Buddhism replaces sin with the acknowledgement of the cause and effect system, known as karma. home-studied Buddhism for a while, and that was, I believe, his inspiration for saying, we are not punished for our sins, we are punished by our sins. We're punished or rewarded by the way we use the principle of life. Are we actually punished? Well, he sort of softens it in another part of the textbook by saying our experience is the inevitable consequence of the way you use the principle. You see, we too see life as a system of cause and effect, a system of inevitable consequence. We think of karma as something that we can be transcended in the twinkling of an eye by simply creating a new cause. In other words, we don't have to wait around when we've thought or done something negative for the other shoe to drop. We don't have to wait around when we've done something negative because we're waiting to see what happens. We can stop what we have set in motion at any time. You can think something or do something terrible and later, much later, or immediately set a new idea in motion. We can immediately create something new. In other words, at any time, we can stop punishing ourselves. And you know, and I know, when I'm punishing myself, I can feel it when I'm doing it, and I can feel the inevitable consequence of it. And it doesn't feel good. It really doesn't. Even if your belief is you're no good and you're looking for some experience to corroborate that belief, and we all do, it doesn't feel good. When it happens, when you're experiencing it at any point, the great mind is one that can make mistakes and never be discouraged by, regardless of how many mistakes are made. Realizing that all a mistake represents is an approach not to use doesn't mean anything more than that. Any mistake you have ever made that you're willing to say, yeah, that was a mistake, in a sense, it wasn't a mistake. It was the inevitable consequence of the way you were thinking at that time. But if you want to call it a mistake, and I've called some of my experiences mistakes, just realize that you were punishing yourself. And that all you found out is that's something you don't want to do. You no longer want to punish yourself. Mental science scientists don't believe that anyone was born to lose, anyone was born to pay off karma, anyone was born to be poor or a not have in any one way. We were born to experience ourselves. We could say we were born to experience God, karma, our spirit, but we were born to experience ourselves, and whether you know it or not, that's exactly what you're doing right now. You're experiencing yourselves. You're listening to me. I may be speaking a truth that you appreciate, that you know is true. However your reaction is, you're not really experiencing me. You're experiencing yourself. As I am not really experiencing you, I'm experiencing myself. Therefore, we don't believe that we have to divest ourselves from worldly pleasures in any way. We believe that the pleasures of life were meant to be experienced, not shunned. And these pleasures include healthy bodies, healthy times, healthy sex lives, healthy relationship, healthy... Did you stop when I said sex life? Woo-woo, indeed. Healthy relationships. Everything is healthy and life-giving. You see, not much greatness is expressed by what we deny ourselves. Self-denial is based on the superstition that those who do without are closer to God. Sort of like Betty Bowers. Anyone ever go to BettyBowers.com? Well, she's so much fun. She teased her hair within an inch of its life because she says the higher the hair, the closer to God. Remember the beehive? Well, Betty, go BettyBowers.com. It'll make you smile. As I said, we do not agree. That would make those of us who are follically challenged, Paul, to be the farthest away from God, and that cannot be true. We intend to experience our greatness, not by what we're willing to deny, but what we have the guts to embrace. Our intention is to express our greatness by being happy, being healthy, being well-adjusted, having the things we want, experiencing love, being able to do what we want to do, having the past, the present, and the future in proper perspective, and taking responsibility for our own experience. We believe that life was meant to be a joyous experience, not a penalty for being born. Life should be lived with courage and boldness, and yes, with greatness, not shame and embarrassment, not as an apology for living. We don't believe that we have to do something to be great either. We only have to be something, and wonderfully enough, it's something we already are. And that is an individualized expression of divine mind. We accept our greatness as a given, not something we have to work for. And when we accept our own divinity, when we accept our own greatness, we don't feel sorry for ourselves, for anything. We don't become martyrs to anyone, and we don't wallow in self-pity. Even though there may be reasons we could, we don't. And if we inadvertently slip into any one of these things, it isn't very long before we change the thoughts that cause them. Now, in the first week of this series called The Basics, we talked about the thing itself, divine mind. In the second week, we talked about the way it works. It works, this divine mind, for us by working through us because it is us all the time. And this week, we're talking about the chapter entitled What It Does, which is really a combination of the first two. Our experience of life, what does it do? It becomes that which our thought causes it to become. So regardless of the way you've lived your life up to this very moment, regardless of the wrongs you think you've done, regardless of how non-great you consider yourself to be, regardless of the experiences you've had, the way that people have perceived you, or the way that you may have even perceived yourself, remember this. This is a great truth which must be remembered, especially by us, the metaphysicians of the world. The kingdom of God is still within us, and our identity in that kingdom cannot be violated. It can't be altered even a fraction, one iota. It's time, I believe, that we express our greatness in our own way. You don't need divine superstition, supervision, and you don't need the supervision of any church. Of any church leader, of any practitioner, of any other human being. You only need the integrity of your own mind, because that's where God is. And the only thing you might need, you already have. A presence of God that works for you because it is in you. A creative principle that responds to your thought. And as I said, the only thing that you might need is a little more confidence in how great you are. We may accept it, but not have any real trust, like George Washington Carver had, a trust that what he wanted to do was right. Well, if you need anything, then it's more confidence in your own greatness and the courage to express that greatness in the best way you know how. And stop waiting. Stop waiting to find out what the best way is. Just try a few things. Greatness, if it's doled out in little pieces, wondering if I'm doling it out the right way. Well, it's greatness, I guess. But give it a shot. You haven't begun to experience the greatness that lies within you, and neither have I. We haven't begun. And we may look at all we've accomplished and think, well, that was great, and this is great. I'm tired of thinking about the fact that I wrote a book, A Great Thing. Who cares? Because the universe in me is calling to me and says, write another one. Quit thinking that your past is what should be celebrated. It isn't even your future that should be celebrated. It's right now. This moment you are great. So I want to close with the poet Rumi and something that he wrote. You've heard it before. Let's dance as though no one was watching. Love as though we've never been hurt. Sing as though no one was listening. Work as though we don't need the money and live as though heaven is on earth. And I will add this. Let's love generously, care deeply, speak kindly, and leave the rest to principle. This day is the day the Lord hath made. The Lord hath made, the universe hath made this day for you to realize how great you really are. That's the truth. Thank you.